from OCA.
Thank you so much for attending. I see that there's some courts out of the Rio Grande Valley, Edinburgh, San Juan, West Acocopari. Welcome. Anybody else from the valley? Where are you you guys from?
Pecos.
Pecos.
Wiley.
You guys? Uvalde? Okay, good.
San Antonio.
Oh, it's okay.
Texas.
Well, as I was introduced, I was the collections manager for the County of Hidalgo before I came to work for the state about 5 years ago. And at that time, the program or the county was utilizing the probation department to do collections. Mr. Salinas was the county clerk and then later became the county judge. Had contacted Mr. Lehman out of the Office of Court Administration at the time because he had heard about the collections program that had been set up in Cameron County, so they brought Mr. Lehman in to look at the program. Well, then Mr. Salinas asked me to start this program for him. Just a little history behind that is that the County of Hidalgo in 1998 had assessed on the county courts of law about $3.5 million and through the efforts that were being done at the time, they had only collected about $800,000. Well, we started the program in 1999 and about the same assessment, about $3.5 million. We went from $800,000 to $2.5 million just implementing the components and procedures set up by the county, the Office of Court Administration. But before we go on, how many of you are grandparents? Grandparents? Compadre, you grandparents? No? We have 11 of them. Those, and don't misunderstand, I love them to death. My wife and I have 11 grandchildren. But can you imagine after a weekend with grandchildren, a couple of, from Thursday all the way to Friday, because at one point my son decided to take a long weekend to Las Vegas with his wife, and of course, they decided to ask us to take care of the kids. And you can imagine from Thursday to Sunday, by Thursday evening, we were ready for them to come home and take care of them. But don't misunderstand, we don't do that. But after a couple of days with them, when my son came back, I told him, I said, look, we've seen the lights of London. We seen the lights of home, but the prettiest lights we've ever seen is the tail lights of the car digging the ground really well. But don't, again, those who are our grandparents understand what I'm saying, right? So anyway, to get started, what's going on here?
Arrow down.
There you go. The Texas Office of Court Administration is a state agency. Was created in 1977 by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court to provide administrative and technical support. So we served approximately a little over 2,600 courts in the state because they have already legislated more courts since we got that number. But we would like to say that we're employed by the state, but we work for you because our job is to make sure that when it comes to collecting court costs, fees and fines, that you understand
what it takes to do that type of work. Okay. This is a three-part presentation. The collections and compliance general overview. We'll be looking at that. The collections, compliance, and keys and components, and collections and compliance toolbox. Through our experience in doing training seminars, we usually get three type of participants. We have our students. When they come in, they have their pen in hand and they start writing as soon as they come in. Then we have our vacationers, the ones that just said, you know what, I'm getting out of here, I'm going to go to a seminar so I can get out of my desk for a couple of days. And then we have our prisoners, the ones that are here and really didn't want to be here. But I hope that after we've done our presentation that you will take a little some knowledge back to your courts. In search of the nugget, this hopefully, when we finish with this, that you can take a little nugget back and turn it into gold. This nugget was found in Austria in October 1872. It weighed 272 pounds, and if you multiply that by $1,000, if $1,000 was the price of gold, it would be worth $7.5 million. The collections, the judicial collections broad overview, the federal, starts with the federal, city, the state, and the county. What we're, and also, the in this overview, we will look how the private sector does collections and how the private sector does collections as far as the, you know, what they do to make sure that their revenues increase. It's more than $40 billion in unpaid government debt. If you look at this, and if you put a $100 bill and stack them on pallets, this is how $40 billion looks like. But I want you to focus on the guy on the red shirt, because later on we'll come back to him. What best picture you think was back 40 billion seconds ago? What best picture do you think, what was the top motion picture that was that came into play 40,000 billion seconds ago? The Midnight Cowboy. And the best album? That it was done by Glenn Campbell. And who were the Super Bowl champs? Any football fans here? Willie Joe Namath. Remember that upset? I still remember it. It's historic. Who was the president 40 billion seconds ago? Richard Nixon, the 37th president, 1969. So in Texas, it's estimated uncollected court costs fines runs about $2.6 billion, and based on a 65% collections rate in 2004, if you look at the graph, it has increased all the way up. And that's only of all the courts that reported their collections rate. That's in how much money is $2.6 billion? Well, every county would receive $10.1 million. Every city would receive $2.8 million. Every court, $900,000. Every judge would receive $785,000. And every resident in the state of Texas would receive $118,000. That's $1 billion look like, and the same concept as we spoke a little while ago. So if you clock back 1 billion seconds, the best picture would be Wings. The best album would be Louis Armstrong. And who do you think the NFL world champions were a billion seconds back? They're not even in the picture today. And Herbert Hoover was the president in 1928. And in 1928, Austin looked like this. Just kidding. It's just a picture that somebody put in there. 1.25 trillion are generated by municipal courts alone. So that indicates that the municipal courts alone are the ones, along with the justice of the peace, but we're talking about municipal courts today, they generate most of the court costs, fees, and fines in the state of Texas, okay? Meaning because of the citations and greater numbers. Remember when I asked you to look at the guy in the red shirt? Look at him now. If you put a $100 bill on pallets and stack them, that's how $1 trillion looks like. And that's what municipal courts alone collect every single year. Who do you think of the president was back then? Any ideas? This guy. Now we're going to talk about the economy. The effects of the economy on government. The first thing that affects the government agencies is a decrease in sales tax. And if you know, if you've been working on your budget, you understand that what we're talking about. Also, it decreases on property tax revenue and buses restrictions. Most of you guys have gone through this, you know, because a lot of courts are now cutting back because of the economy. Of course, with budget restrictions, layoffs always comes into play. And the other thing that comes into play is increase in delinquency and unpaid debt. And the reason... The effects of the economy on the courts. And one of the reasons is because there's always staff reduction. If the budget gets cut, they reduce the staff. And if you don't have people in your courts and to work your delinquency, well, your delinquency always grows. And your budget always is restricted. And of course, with the economy the way it is, one of the things that happens is the caseload always increases. And the increase in delinquencies. And of course, when there's an increase in delinquencies, there's always an increase in defaults. And we will be talking to you about that and how to handle those defaults. Once again, if there's any questions that you might have while the presentation is going on, don't hesitate and ask, okay? Because this is an open forum. And so the question is, how important is court collections and why? Why is court collections important? Is it important because it's about the money, or is it important because of other things? On the scale from 1 to 10, on the back of your paper, write 1 being the least and 10 being the highest. Write a number that you think, what you think about the court's collections. If you think the court collections are important, write that number down in from 1 to 10, 1 being the least and 10 being the highest. And we'll talk about that later also. The general attitude about court's collections is the court philosophy. These people can't pay, and it's not my job. And that's what we found throughout the state, that the philosophy of most of the courts. And since I worked in a border county when I ran the collections program, one of the things that that came up when we first started the collections program is how can you collect from people that are too poor to pay? Remember the numbers that I gave you at the beginning? 3.5 million collected before the collections program, 2.5 million after, on the same assessment. Well, that the thing with a collections program is that you put people on a payment plan, and if you put people on a payment plan, usually, and you tell them that that is required, usually, it's, well, that's what they're going to do. They're going to take care of the court costs, fees, and fines. Now, as far as the people being too poor to pay, well, a lot of in the border counties like El Paso, Webb County, Starr County, Hidalgo, all the way up to Cameron County. Everybody said, "Well, it's how are you going to collect from these people if they can't afford to take care of their fines and fees? How are you going to collect from them?" Well, the philosophy of the courts at the time was, if you don't have the money, go see the clerk, and the clerk will let you know, the clerk will take care of you. The clerk would do all the paperwork and do all the interest, and they would send them to the probation department, because we're talking about at that Hidalgo County, and the probation department would put them on the payment plan that they thought, because of the information that they got from the defendant, that they could pay. If a guy earning $50,000 and he said he could only pay $50 a month, that's usually what happened. If a guy that was earning $10,000 and said that he could only pay $5 a month, usually that's what happened. But and what happens is that when you have this kind of attitude, it reflects back in the community, because they don't expect their perception is that they don't expect to pay anything, because that's the perception out in the community. It says they don't expect us to pay, and nobody cares. And if you don't think that it's out in the community, that when you send somebody home and you tell them that to come back in 10, 20, or 30 days, and then you can take care of these fines, look at the warrants that are issued in your courts. And the reason is because they know that there's so many warrants out there, and you don't have enough people to solve those warrants, and the people in the committee know that nothing's going to happen to them. Why? Because that's the perception in the community. And of course, government, we don't have the time and money to invest. If you go back to the commissioners and you ask them, he said, "Well, we don't have the time, we don't have the money to invest in programs like this." So the common side effects is the perception that people can't pay. So what happens? Low priority as expectations. That's what happens. And then they, when you set them up on this type of terms, relatively set terms, it's usually inconsistent. Because if you send them home because they didn't have the money when they came to court, and you gave them whatever amount of time from 10 to 30 days to come back, usually they're, if you're like any other court in the state, most of those people are not going to come back. They're not going to come back and do what you told them to do. And when those terms are set, then what happens is that there is a weak follow-up and a high default rate. At the end of 30 days, usually what happens is they come back to you and say, well, this person didn't show up, so you you issue a warrant. And that's the next point. And of course, the warrants as a solution is expensive and often ineffective. And this, and I go back to what I just told you a little while ago. You probably have more warrants outstanding than you have people to serve those warrants, right? And usually what happens with people that with those people is that either they reoffend and you catch up with them, and then they go back to the same routine, and you set them up, and they come back to you, and they tell you the same story, that they don't have the money. Either you send them back and say, okay, we're going to give you another chance, I'm going to give you another 20 days. And guess what? They go back in the same cycle. And most of those warrants are not served. They're out there, but there's not enough, like I said, there's not enough people out there to go knock on doors and serve their warrants. So it's expensive, and it's often ineffective. And it's like the credit recycle, you know, it also is expensive and ineffective for the same reasons. They just go through the same cycle back, and they recycle through the court systems. And I know that you have a lot of those kind of peoples in your court. And again, the perception is that they can't pay. And you hold on, did I give? Okay. Presumption, an attitude or belief dictated by probability. One of the things that we're going to look at is not everything that comes to your court is you know, what you see. And you think you might have a good handle on them, but usually you don't. Who do you think this guy is?
Dead.
He's dead, right? Michael Jackson? How about this young lady? Well, not young anymore, but she's a lady. And these two guys? Who do you think they are? Anybody know? Buddy, you should know. There you go. Okay. You know what? What you see is usually not what you get, because these guys were Hollywood impersonators. Okay? Let's take the first case study. This case study, Joe Trudet and his wife his wife Jody share a textbook history of domestic violence, okay? And what we're what we just talked about is what you see is not always what you get, right? You thought that it was Michael Jackson's. We thought it was Dolly Parton, and we thought it was Lauren Hardy, but they were Hollywood impersonators. So, but let's look at a case study. And usually, these case studies go through your courts. Not necessarily this case, but something similar to this. This couple shared a textbook history of domestic violence. Black eyes, broken bones, broken promises. Joe had already served three years in probation for pulling a gun on his older sister. He has spent time in jail for two misdemeanor assaults against his wife. And another two cases were pending. Once in a fit of rage, Jody said he pushed her out of a speeding car. Now, if Joe is found guilty, pleads guilty on this case, or to the third assault charge, because he broke Jody's jaw, the maximum fine in this case would be $10,000. Okay. Now you guys are the judges. Some of you guys are judges. So. That's the maximum fine, okay? As a judge, would you impose the maximum fine? Knowing the history of this guy, has all kinds of domestic violence history. As a judge, would you impose a maximum fine? If the maximum fine is imposed, do you think this guy can pay? And recall that, you know, what you see is not always what you get. You know, remember that, have that in the back of your mind, because everything that comes to your court, what you see in front of you is really not what you get. And this is what we're trying to get through you to you through this case study. If less than the maximum is imposed, why would you impose the less than the maximum? Let's take the second case study. This guy is from out of town, and let's say he's from California. He's got a third grade education. He's between 60 and 70 years old. He's unemployed, and he lives with relatives. And he owes $5,000 in court costs and fines. Do you think this guy can pay that $5,000? And I'm asking a question. If you can respond to that question, I would truly appreciate it. And if you don't think that he can, why don't you think that he can? Is it because he's got a third grade education? Or is it because he's between 65 and 70 years old? Or because he's unemployed? Or because he lives with relatives? See, all these things come in play when people come into your court. But what you see is not always what you get. Because this guy is Jed Clampett, and he's got all his money in Mr. Drisdale's bank. Right? But if you didn't know the difference, if you didn't know this guy was a multimillionaire, would you think, if you saw him the way he was, would you think that this guy could afford to pay the $5,000 that were assessed to him? And most likely, you would not, because what you see is not always what you get. You think that the guy was unemployed, can't afford it, and lives with relatives. The side effects, again, the same concepts. Perceptions, campaign, randomly set terms. They become inconsistent. Weak follow-ups, high default rates. Who can't pay? That's the question. And who are we dealing with when we deal with people in our courts? Crimes and criminals. One, the definition is one who commits a crime Crime, that's a criminal. Crime is an act or a commission of an act that is forbidden or the omission of a duty that is commanded by public law that makes the offender liable to punishment by law. When we talk about criminals, this is what we usually think about. People that are in prison, and that's what we look at. There were 11.4 million new criminal cases filed in the state of Texas in 2008. Out of this new cases, only 9% were at the county and district court level. As of 2007, the latest figures available, there were approximately 500,000, or 2% of the state population, offenders in supervised probation in the state of Texas. There are approximately 150,000, or less than 1/10% of less than 1/10 of 1% of the state population, adult inmates in the state of Texas. 59% of all those prisoner inmates have a high school education or diploma or equivalency. 2/3 of all prison inmates were employed the month before they were arrested for their current offense. I want you to also understand what the numbers that we're presenting to you, because we're getting to the point where you will see that we're not looking at the people that I just showed you a little while ago.
Could you?
Yes, sir.
Could you trigger, I try to find those in the handout. It's not in here, is it?
Is it? It should be.
Should be.
Yeah.
Not everything
is
in here.
Oh, really?
It seems like just a big conference.
Because it was very interesting, and I was wondering if you could email it.
Oh, you're talking about
the
stats and all that stuff. Okay, yeah, sure. We can do that. I think that did you guys jot down your email addresses and your names?
We should.
No. Okay. We'll do that.
Hold on. You should have our email addresses.
Oh,
they should have our.
If you have a brochure, our email address is on the back.
Again, we're looking at the criminals and what we think criminals look like. But most of the criminals look like this. That come before your court, not necessarily those two, but they're what we usually call citizens, normal citizens of the community. You know, people that get a traffic ticket or for whatever reason they got into trouble and they need to the services of the court, but usually they're not a menace to society, right? They're not the type of guys that we just saw that are in the prison system. They're people just like us. And again, we go back to the common side effects of, that we just talked about. Okay, now we're going to talk about, all these people that come to your courts. Why they can pay? Because now we're going to talk about show me the money. And if you look at this, it's according to the American Collectors Association. No matter what your income status is, and I want you to focus on this one right here. no matter what your income status is, most people spend other and discretionary out of their whatever money that come into their hands. 14% is usually spent in this discretionary. So if they can spend that money at Walmart, or they can spend that money at the movies, or buying fajitas for the weekend barbecue, don't you think that they can afford to take care of their court cost, fees, and fines that are assessed by your courts? It is estimated that Texas courts assessed approximately $1.7 billion in court costs, fees, and fines in the year fiscal year 2008, or about $77 for every person in the state. In fiscal year 2008, the state of Texas reported approximately $3.67 billion in gross lottery ticket sales, or about $166 for every person in the state. I want you to go ahead, sir.
That includes all courts, district courts, county courts.
Yeah, on the part first part, yes, sir. That's what in the state of Texas, what it was assessed. But I want you to focus on the second part. In the fiscal year, the state of Texas reported approximately over almost $4 billion in gross lottery sales, okay? Or $166 for every person in the state. Now, it's estimated that in fiscal year 2008, the average case assessed in the state courts was approximately $200 per case, okay? And a recent study of the state's lottery found that the lottery players that with incomes lower than $10,000, okay? And hear me out, lower than $10,000 spent an estimated $600 per year playing the lottery ticket. In 2008, the average court cost the average case assessed in the state of Texas was approximately $200 with court cost, fees, and fines. And these people spent, if they make less than $10,000, they spent almost $600 in lottery tickets. A person that earns, also in the same study, it was found that lottery players with incomes over $50,000 to $100,000 spent about $225 a year playing the lottery tickets. And when we talked about a little while ago about discretionary funds, they spend 14% of whatever they comes into their hands in other things but paying their bills. And then we go back to the same reminder of the presumption that people can't pay. Why can't they pay? They spend $600 a year in lottery tickets. Your average case that comes through your court is $200 per case. If you set terms, then you go back to the inconsistency. If you don't have a weak follow up or no follow up procedures in place, you have high default rates. And if again you go back to the warrants as a solution, what are we going to do with the warrants? It's expensive and ineffective, and we all can testify to that or attest to that. And I mean, when they come back to your courts, if they ever are stopped for whatever reason, and they have a warrant and they come back to your courts, usually what happens is it's a recycle or credit given because either they serve time in jail or they come back through the courts. And let me talk a little bit about time served. When there's a warrant issued,
And there is no effort to collect the money from these people. If there's a warrant issued and that warrant is served, usually the city, the municipality loses the money, because what happens is, once you see that defendant come to your court, you're going to give him time search, and the court costs and fines are going to go away, and you spend between $50 to $70 a day housing that defendant. So really, is the warrant a solution to the problem? And
we say no. And that's why we said we're setting procedures in place to help you guys collect the money up front. When you see set this kind of terms, when somebody comes to your court, some of the courts have no partial payments or payouts. If they come to your court, you say, "Well, you don't have the money. You're gonna have to pay me everything today." If they don't have all the money, they're going to leave your courts with money in their pockets. You're going to tell them, "Well, I don't have all the money. Well, I can't accept partial payments. So you go, I'm going to give you 30 days, let's say, to bring the money in, all the money at once." They might have part of it, and you send them home. And that's the one of the problems with no partial payments or payouts. Usually, when you let them go, they're not going to come back. They usually don't come back. Court costs required at pleading or sentencing. Some courts require that people pay their court costs when they come to the court. And if you set those guidelines, what do you think is going to happen? If they know that's what they have to do, exactly that's what they're going to do. They'll pay the court costs, fees, and fines. And we go back to the first one with no partial payments. If they know that they're not expected to pay, that's exactly what's going to happen. And what's the problem with automatic 30-day extension? Again, I go back to the same thing. Most of the people won't come back to your courts. Now, let's say that you give a maximum paid out from $5 to $50 a month. What's wrong with that picture? If they owe you $300 or $600 and they're paying $5 a month, or even $50 a month, oh yeah, they'll continue to, they'll start paying you, but statistics show that they will fall off. The longer you have them in a payment plan, statistics show that they will fall off, and you won't collect the rest of the money. So what we, again, try to collect as much money up front as possible. The six common reasons for non-payment. What do you think are the six reasons for people not making their payments? Do you think it's neglect, confusion, temporary financial difficulty, seasonal, unexpected disaster, or deliberate? What do you think is the top reason for people not complying with your court ordered payment, or for non-payment? You're right. 70% of the people that leave your court confused, if they leave your court confused, usually don't come back. Because when they come to your court, most of them, if they're not repeat offenders and they know the system, they'll come to your court and they don't know exactly what they need to do. They'll leave confused, and usually they don't come back because if there's no follow-up to remind them, they usually don't come back.
You know, if I may add something.
Sure.
What I think confuses people a lot is when you start breaking down court costs and fines and those types of things, they don't seem to be able to distinguish. I think most defendants want you to just tell them, "You owe X amount of dollars, you have to pay it this way." It's what I find, the more you explain, the less they understand.
Sure. That works for your court judge in the sense that there's a court cost and a fine to be assessed. Is that that's correct, right? If you tell them that the total is $500 and $200 of those are court costs, and $300 is the fine. If that works for you, I think that the least confusion that people have, the better it is for them to bring in the money. But 10% 10% is people that really deliberately don't want to pay. They know more about not paying than we know about collecting. And we've been in the business for a lot of years. And you always got that 10% of people that are not going to pay no matter what kind of pressures you put on them or calls or whatever, or letters or notices sent, they're not going to pay. So, but there's the far and in between.
You want to?
Yeah, you want to.
Go ahead and explain that one too.
Okay. Tell me when you want to jump back in.
After this one, I'll jump back in.
Okay. All right. This is an example, and it's an actual example of what Mr. Castile was talking about as far as confusion. Usually when we show that slide, it says 70% of the people that you deal with don't pay, and that's not our statistic. That's the American Collectors Association saying that. It's not us. People look like, I don't believe that. But it's true, and this is an example of how we get to that. I was the collections manager for Dallas County Criminal Courts maybe a month or a month and a half, and I'm at my desk, and all of a sudden there's an excitement out in the hallway. I don't know what it is, but you can hear people, and you can hear shouts, and suddenly you see people running about. And one of the clerks from the court came in, and she was just, all excited, and she said, "Big Toe is here. Big Toe is here." And I'm going like, "Who is Big Toe? What is a Big Toe?" You know. And to make a long story short, Big Toe is a frequent vagrant that every 6 months or so gets picked up and brought in. It's only significant in that he has a disability or a problem with his foot where it is like 10 times the normal size of anybody else's foot. And it's very grotesque, and he doesn't put anything on it. And he's become this almost celebrity, like whenever he does show up, creates a lot of stir, and people, everywhere wants to see this when he comes in. So my question to you, and we have a picture, it's not the actual Big Toe, but we have a picture similar to it, not the same thing. So I'm cautioning you in advance if you don't want to see that, or if you just ate lunch or something, you might want to just kind of shield your head. But anyway, you've got the initial part of this story. What do you think I did? Do you think I went out and checked Mr. Big Toe out, or calmly went back to my desk and went to work? More importantly, what would you have done?
I'm going out to see it.
I would love to tell you that I was really calm, cool, and collected and ignored it all together, but I did not. I had to go see it. And in fact, I did. And I'll show it to you. And it's not that bad, but if you saw it 10 times bigger than this, it was something to see, believe me. But my point is, and the reason why we're talking about this, is going back to the previous slide. The previous slide said 70% of the people don't do things because they're confused, and only 10% are deliberate. That's not what we think in our mind's eye. We think that a whole lot more people are negligent or they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing. But what do you think I talked about at the dinner table that night? Do you think I talked about the many, many people who quietly came in and made their payments? Or do you think I talked about Big Toe? Talked about Big Toe. We have a tendency to see things the way they affect us. And what sticks with us are those knuckleheads that come in and keep us going And we simply ignore that more than half of the people that we deal with, we never see or never have to talk to. They take care of their business because they don't want to have anything to do with you or the court. They want to get out of it as quickly as possible. But what we focus on, are the big toes.
Do I stop that? Or?
Yeah, you can stop it. If you want to.
Yeah. Well, just to wake you up a little bit. But we'll be taking a break in a little bit. But is it just about the money? Are we really just talking about money? This little girl here, it's another case out of Florida. Do you remember seeing this case on TV? It was on the national news where this guy adopted this little girl in, in front, close to a car wash, and you could see it in the camera when she grabbed her by the hand and walked her out. And she was raped and killed by the guy that adopted her. This is a guy. His name is Joseph Smith. And the reason this guy was out, he was on probation. But he was free even though that he had violated probation for the terms. Failure to pay court costs, fees, and fines. That's the reason he was out. The judge in that case, of course, he took a lot of heat for that, for the ruling or for the statement that he made. The statement that he made that there was no debtor's prison in Florida and Smith wouldn't have been held simply for not paying a bill. You focus on what word there, on that statement. The last word, bill. When you owe court costs, fees, and fines, it's not a bill. It's ordered. It's a court ordered. It's an order by the court. And if you think that of the people that come to your court, and when you do the assessment, that they owe a bill, it's not. It's an order of the court. The message that was sent by that court is that some court's orders are more important than others. Compliance is sometimes optional, and the system is broken. The impact of unpaid fines. There's the loss of public revenue, the decrease in services, an increase in taxes, and also a weaker government. When fines are and fees are not paid and court costs, usually what happens is there's the loss of that revenue affects the court system, and if the revenue is not there, will also affects the services. And the other thing that happens is that usually taxes go up because they have to generate the city or the government has to generate the monies to have to continue the work of the government. And sometimes the potential is even greater. That friends and the friends and family are the ones that suffer because of the court orders not being adhered to. how important is quartz collections? And as I mentioned a while ago, to write a number down between 1 and 10, one being the least and 10 being the greatest. But the issue is the lack of compliance in paying court costs, fees, and fines denies a jurisdiction revenue, and more importantly, calls into question the authority and effectiveness of the court and the justice system. That's why it's not all about the money. As you recall that we were talking about that people have no respect. If people if you give them time, they don't show up, and if their perception is that nobody cares, this is the issue, right? They lose respect for the justice system. That's why it's not all about the money, but it's also respect for the law. If the law's broken, there's consequences, and those laws need to be adhered to. If a crime goes unpaid, and this is from a book, probably the greatest book ever written in my opinion, if a crime goes unpunished, the people will believe that it's safe to do wrong. And what did I talk about a little while ago about people not paying? And if the perception is that you're not going to, if you go to a certain court in this state, for example, let's say any court in the state of Texas, that people are given time or extensions, for example, and they're not required to make payments, and nothing is done to make these people adhere to the court orders. This, the perception in the community or the is that people don't care, and whatever you do, if you commit a crime in whatever city that you are that you're from, if that's the case, people already know it's safe to do wrong. I can go speeding through your city, I get a ticket, I don't have to pay it because nothing's going to happen, because I already know that because it's all over the community that nothing's going to happen. Oh, sure, a warrant might be issued, but chances are, again, that warrant is not going to be that warrant not going to be executed. Yes, sir. Yes, go ahead.
We've seen a lot of defendants requesting community service. Mm-hmm. How do you handle that? We have some guidance within the courts too, when it's appropriate, when it's not. We've seen a rise in that. And also, as far as if you understand or you believe that they just don't want to pay,
right?
The contempt powers of the court, can you hold? How long can you hold them for, in lieu of payment or under contempt for just not obeying the court's rule? Do you have any guidance on that? I mean that. That's a lot I just threw at you.
Yeah, I know, and I'm not a judge. Okay, we deal with collections program and helping courts set up a collections program in their courts. Now, the first part of your question was about community service. When I was a manager for Hidalgo County, one of the things that I tried to do the least is community service. First thing that the way that I handled was, if you have a job, you can pay me, all right? If you're working, you can pay me. Now, if you want to do community service, yes, I can accommodate you. But my community service is going to start at 8 o'clock in the morning, and it's going to go all the way through 5 o'clock, and it's going to be Monday through Friday. I'm not saying that you do this, but I'm just saying what I did. And the first thing they're going to say is that, well, I have a job. Well, if you have a job, you can pay me. And I'm going to set you up with a payment plan so that you can, I can help yourself. But this is what you're trying to do when you have a collections program in place in your court system, that you're helping people get out of the system. It's not going to go straight to warrants. If I'm going to put you in a payment plan, if you default, I'm going to send you a letter. I'm going to first make a call.
I'm going to send you a letter, and if all the means have exhausted, then I will issue a warrant. But if I issue a warrant, I will also go look for you. It's not going to be a piece of paper saying that, right? No. I think that City of Edinburgh has, and Marty is here from the City of Edinburgh, they have the correct, they set it up to where they have two warrant options. If they, and they help them, they put them on the payment plan, but if they default, the warrant officer is going out the doors. And it's, the warrant officer is not also used to put them, to put people in jail. It's just for them to make sure, that, to let them know that we mean business, right? That collection tool, right? Now, if they have to arrest people because they're defiant, they will do that. But most of the cases that come, the good awards or that are served by the warrant officer, I would venture to say that 95% of those, either the payment plan is reworked, or they pay everything that they owe, or they bring it up to date. And this is what you're trying to do with a program like this. You're not trying to put them out there and just say, okay, you don't want to pay, that's fine, we'll just eat your warrant, because it usually doesn't work. Now, in talking about Edinburgh, I remember when we first contacted Edinburgh, and I think they were collecting between $800 to $1 million a year and without the program. And they went from that money to what, $3-4 million? Mm-hmm. Yeah, from 1 year to the next. And it's just by sending the people up in the plan. And I'm not saying that the warrants are going to go away, but you're going to have a lot less warrants than you're issuing now, right? There's a lot of work for to be done when a warrant is issued. You know, the clerks have to do the entrance. The judge has to look at it and decide whether that warrant, he's going to sign the warrant or not. So there's a lot of work. So with this plan that we're trying to help the courts do, is that we're trying to get them to pay the money up front as much as possible. 90% of the people that come to your courts have money in their pockets, all right? You have to have a system in place, a accounts receivable mechanism, and we'll talk about that in a little while. To bring in that money. And I don't want to get ahead of myself, but you don't go to a store and ask for credit and an application not taken. You don't go to a store where you owe money. You don't go to a store or business and say, I'll pay maybe in 30 days, or I'll pay in 6 months. Well, if these people are not paying in 30 days, well, guess what? Somebody's going to make a call, a letter's going to be sent, because they want their money, and their money, and, you know, and this. And the other question was, Judge, and
They show up and they say, mm-hmm. I don't have any money, and I just don't want to pay.
Right.
How long can you detain them? And I guess there's two mechanisms. One is for lack of payment, mm-hmm. and a warrant goes out. And the other one is just for plain contempt of court.
Contempt of court, because court costs and fines are due the day they come to court. Okay, they're due. Okay, and it's up to the court to decide. And here, again, once again, we're not here to tell the court what to do. There's statutes that you have to hear by. Okay, but we're trying to where you see the difference. For example, the you pay me now, or I'm not going to. If you don't pay me in full. I don't want any money, even though you have it. But I'll give you 30 days to go get it. That system doesn't work. That's what we're trying to show you, right? Because it's already showing that there's more warrants out there, right? That there is money being collected. It's up to the court to decide. According to statute, what the court can or cannot do with
Aaron,
that.
Let me give the judge this statute while we're on this topic. If you look at 45.046, 45.046 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. That's the procedures that we have in municipal court. It talks about that the judge may commit the defendant if they find that the defendant, if this is post-judgment, if they find that the defendant is not indigent and has not made a good faith effort to discharge the fine and cost. And so I just wanted to interject that specific statute you were referring to. That's where you're going to find it. And then also it talks about if you do commit someone to jail, that you want to go to 45.048. And that talks about you're going to discharge it at a rate of a minimum, I believe, of $50 a day. So look to the, those are two specific statutes to municipal court.
And there's only, and there's certain hours that they can do per day. It's not that they're mandatory to do 8 hours a day or anything. It's like,
it says 24 hours in this statute, and you see 8 hours in other statutes, so that's kind of tricky. And those of you from the Valley, there's a JP, that case where the judge's kids who aren't going to school, failure to attend school, she jailed one girl for 3 months. And so that was held to be, I guess, excessive punishment, cruel and unusual. Thanks, Aaron. I just wanted to interject that right now.
Thank you.
Does it identify, does it tell you how much time? It says that you can commit, but does it say for how long?
It says...
We're talking about Class Cs,
right? Right, now. Right. And 45 is where we find our procedures. So it says a convicting court may specify a period of time that is not less than 8 hours or more than 24 hours as the period for which the defendant who fails to pay the fine and cost in the case must remain in jail to satisfy $50 of the fine and cost. So some judges may say if you serve 8 hours, then that's a day. Others may say you're going to do
24 hours.
I think, Aaron, with your 8 to 5, you probably haven't been there all day.
Well, that's in community service. That's part of what the municipal courts face. And this is all very good, but the problem here is the enforcement. Now, you're looking at Class Cs. In our municipality, we can put someone in jail for no more than 3 days, which is $450. And you're looking at municipal judges being restricted by the Class C, and we can only commit somebody for 3 days. They owe you $5,000, $8,000, and I've seen those cases where somebody just had failed to appear one after the other, and you end up with $4,000 or $5,000 in fines.
Well, that's per case, Judge. Per case. If they owe you $5,000, usually there are multiple cases, no?
Yeah. They're multiple cases. They had several fines issued over a period of time. You know, I had a girl, a lady, that every 3 months was given a ticket for no insurance stuff and never bothered to show up. And eventually, after 4, 5, 6 years, they ended up with over $7,000 in fines. So you're actually facing what is the answer? You can't commit her for $7,000 worth of jail time. We can only do 3 days. And that's all you on capes pro fine warrants. The first warrant, they just pick you up. If you make an arrangement with the court and then not show up, you issue a capes pro fine, you can do the same thing as you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have those limitations, right? Well, for 3 days.
Yeah, and it depends on the court and the jail also, the size of the jail.
Extension form, which is the 3 or 4 page extension form, if you're utilizing the one in the forms book and determine whether that person is indigent.
I just wanted to comment on the lady judge or chairman, I'm sure.
I'm the court administrator.
Court administrator. When I hear somebody say, and the defendant says, well, but I don't have the money, but of course, as your chart showed, they have a job, they have a roof over their head, they eat every day.
And this by 14% of
but it's but I just go paycheck to paycheck. That is not indigency.
That's not indigency.
That's poor budget planning. That's a lot of things, but it's not indigency. And I just had one this last week, and I told her, it's not my job to look at your budget and say, do you cut the extra tiers on the table, or, you know, what do you do? But you can come up. You simply have to come up with it. Yeah.
And with this program that's if you look at an application has you do they fill it out and give you all that information. They're interviewed by a person that is trained to do that. And by the time they come to your court, you know exactly, you know, for their financially and otherwise. If they're indigent, you will find out real quick. You know, most get, you have to have a rehearing and all this stuff. Usually you find out real, with a collector's program in place, you'll find the data come to court whether they're indigent or not. Now the other thing is about the new services that some people do, it's a tool that can be used when people, if they're indigent, doesn't mean that they can't do government service. All right? If they don't have the money to pay, sure, you can put up to watch cars or work in the parks and stuff like that. That's fine. Now they can work from 8 to 5. And they want to work.
Sir, what about liability in that standpoint? Do you deal with community service hours, liability in the municipality?
Well, I think
there's not other organizations that you can refer them to, right? That's what our city has done.
You have
that instead of having them do the community service within the city, we mm-hmm. have them go look for a nonprofit organization and we have a list for them.
And actually, if you make it, I'm not saying purposely make it cumbersome, but we do the same thing. We're a small city in the midst of 1.5 million people. Mm-hmm. So we don't have a jail. We don't mm-hmm. have a lot of these other tools. So when somebody, they don't even qualify for community service unless they are indigent. Mm-hmm. Quite often those are
sure.
minors that truly don't have any discretion with money themselves. But then they have to, when I explain it all to them, then all of a sudden they're thinking maybe paying is a better option.
Right.
They have to go find the agency, mm-hmm. track them down, get them to send a letter on letterhead to us. And it has to be approved. I said it can't just be some babysitting service.
Sure.
It's
got
to be approved.
Just mark it down under a
mosquito. And then we have to approve it, then you have to go do it, they have to keep track of the time, then send it back. It's about a 10-step process by the time you get to the other. Mm-hmm. Bob will say, well, maybe I can. I have another 30 that
Well, and the other thing is that when you look at community service, and again, you need to be very careful who you're sending them off to, right? Because there have been some cases in courts that I've heard about where they only pay the $20 for whoever signs a cheat, and they bring it back as they did community service, right? So you need to be very, very careful. As far as liability tax, I don't know if you recall this past week, we had problems in the Rio Grande Valley, the Rio Grande River. It's flooding. They're utilizing the prisoners to fill the sandbags. Those things, the county, for example, the county of Hidalgo has what we did was, as far as community service was, before you were assigned to community service, there was a safety class that you had to take. Okay? And that safety class did not count against whatever you owed. And then we went with the 8 hours a day, Monday through Friday. And if you, mine was very strict. If in the middle of the week you decided that this is done too much for me and I would rather pay it, well, you're going to have to pay the full amount because whatever you work, it's not going to count against what you owe. Right? So it's not something that can make it easy for them. Because a lot of people out there, if they have a job, usually they can make a payment. They might not be able to pay you everything within 30 days, but within 90 days or 120 days, surely they can. Now remember, they spend $600 a year in lottery tickets. It's like I told one lady one time, he said, well, I can't pay you, I just don't have the money. He said, well, what were you doing? Didn't I see you at Walmart the other day? He said, what do you mean you saw me at Walmart? I just threw it out there because 98% of us go to Walmart, right? Right? So he said, well, you saw me at Walmart? Yeah, I saw you at Walmart. But these are techniques that the collector uses to make sure that these people are telling the truth. Either they spend the money, the 40% of discretionary funds, and they can spend the $600 in live tickets a year, they can surely pay their court costs and fines, at least on a time to play.
Go ahead. What we did is we had our own in-house community service and the option to farm them out if we wanted to different nonprofits, but different programs. Ours was self-insured, but we also got to sign a waiver. And there is some government immunity. There's statutory government immunity that would prohibit them from suing you as far as liability is concerned. And then some programs actually establish a insurance policy. They buy an insurance policy. And if the defendant participates in it, they're required to pay part of the premium in order to participate.
Excuse me, I need something clarified. That gentleman over there was saying that there's limited to 3 days in jail.
That's no. Their size of the jail.
Okay.
That's probably this attraction. The size of the city, what a Westlake jail is.
Actually, the municipality set a limit of 3 days.
No? 3 days. Oh, that's what they said. Not just because of the jail.
That's not statute.
Not statute.
No, there's
ordinance.
Ordinance, yeah. Ordinance.
Local ordinance.
I have seen in defining contempt powers, the municipal judges are limited to 3 days. I can't remember where I read that. You might know better, but
it's not in the statutes. No, you're not restricted by no 3 days. It may be an ordinance.
Right.
Ordinance, something is ordered by you. The city's management table, but you can stack them. You said something about what, $2,000 worth of fines?
Yeah.
Yes.
That and he said he could only get 3 days out of that. I can get as much money as I need.
Yeah, but we're talking about two different things.
Also,
not paying is not necessarily contempt of court. If you issue a warning, they fail to pay. That's failure to pay,
mm-hmm.
And so that you might be able to stack them or do whatever per case, and that's another issue that I think that judge was talking about, that it's not 3 days for the whole thing, it's per case.
A lot of times
they add up. However, I did read somewhere, and I'll be happy to look it up for you tonight, where contempt powers were held, maybe not a statute, but by judicial authority, common law, through maybe Supreme Court of talking about, that it's not 3 days for the whole thing, it's per case. A lot of times they add up. However, I did read somewhere, and I'll be happy to look it up for you tonight, where contempt powers were held, maybe not a statute, but by judicial authority, common law, through maybe Supreme Court of Texas, the municipal judge could not hold somebody longer than 3 days. Meaning if somebody flips me the bird in the court, I can't put him in jail for 3 years. And I've seen that before, and I'll be happy to look that up. That's exactly what I just said. Yeah.
Contempt of court.
And they're two different things, and they kind of, that's what I was asking. It's kind of a gray line right there. They kind of, when they don't pay, they're also being offensive to the court, but it's different, the warrant versus the contempt.
Okay, since we actually went a little bit over time, we're going to take a break for about 10 minutes, and then we'll resume.
In introducing our esteemed panel, I neglected to introduce myself as the person interrupting from the back. My name is Kathy Riedel. I'm the program director here at TMCEC. I've been with TMCEC for 2 years now, and prior to that, I worked as a municipal judge and prosecutor and pretty much gopher, anything to do with municipal court, so work there. So I'm enjoying my time here, and I'll turn it over to Jim.
Thanks, Kathy. Appreciate it. Okay, we got two more sections that we want to cover. Most folks are usually interested in toolboxing, and Carolyn's going to deal with that. I'm going to go through my section, and again, stop me if I'm hitting something that you want to discuss. Judicial approaches. Historically, there's been really two approaches. One is the blunt approach, where you just issue the warrant. I wish I had the old Clint Eastwood music, the Hang 'em High music or whatever it is, but this approach, this judicial approach is, you know, no in between. If you don't do what I say you're going to do, then we're just going to issue the warrant. And then exactly the opposite, the 360 of that is the benevolent approach. And that formula up there, 2p squared equals zero, stands for too poor to pay. Mr. Castile talked about that a little bit earlier. In the benevolent approach, we go way over on the other side, and we give away everything that we can in an attempt to resolve the issue with the defendant. There's two things. There's one thing that both of these approaches have in common. They both usually lead to the same thing. One gets there fast, one gets there slow, and that's a warrant. Because ultimately, if you give people way too much time and you have way too little amount to pay, if it's not hurting that much, then eventually they're going to end up being a warrant. And if you don't give them any room whatsoever, then you're going to end up in the same place. So, but historically, this is where it's ended up, with the warrant as the answer. And can the warrant be an answer? I'm not going to tell you that the warrant cannot be an answer. It can, but you guys know as well as I do, certain things have to happen in order for that to work. The community has to believe that the warrant means something. The community has to believe that there is a high probability that that warrant is going to get executed. And when I say the community, I mean that there has to be a community knowledge. In Central Texas, where I'm from in Austin, everybody speeds through right there on I-35. Everybody speeds through Travis County. They slow up when they get to Williamson County, which borders Travis. There's a reason for that. Williamson County has a reputation of having no nonsense. You speed through our town, you're going to go to jail, and we may forget about you there. They've worked really hard at cultivating that reputation. If that's the kind of reputation you have, and if your community believes that if the warrant is going to get served, then this works. Most of us don't. That's the reason why there are 3.7 million of those things issued in 2008, and about the same or a little bit more in 2009. And that's a lot. You'd have to have 12 prisoners per bed, be the third largest city. If you rounded them all up, put them in one place, and it would be larger than 20 states. So is the warrant actually an answer? In most instances, it's not. Now, there's a third approach to collections. That's the one that we really like to emphasize and talk about. And that's the approach where the court actually, the approach to collections is calculated to cultivate compliance. It's the business approach. It's the business approach. You want to look at this the way you would look at any other accounts receivable situation. Why? Well, if you look at the collection matrix, you can see what's happened historically. The private sector, these symbols are up here not just to look good. These symbols represent effort. The private sector, historically, they put all their effort on the front end. All their resources, everything they do is structured to deal with the things on the front end, because they know the more they do up front, the easier it gets as they go through the process. Conversely, the court systems have done it exactly the opposite way. Very little is done up front, so more effort has to be extended on the back end in order to get any type of compliance. Now, why would the private sector spend all of that time and energy working up front, doing the front end? Well, private sector is only in business for one reason: to make money. So it has to work, or they wouldn't be doing it. So this is kind of what happens in the private sector. The private sector has an accounts receivable mechanism. That little blue arrow represents an accounts receivable mechanism. And that can be phone calls, letters, notices. They have a plan so that when an account enters the collections pipeline, that accounts receivable mechanism pushes it through the pipeline. Something is there to help it get past the hump. In the courts, most of the time, that accounts receivable mechanism is just not there. It doesn't exist. Therefore, you have cases that get stuck in the pipeline. That's why you have 3.7 million warrants. So, what do you do? what we think is the best process is to put somebody in charge of facilitating the collections. If the defendant really can't pay, and we just had a really good discussion about community service, but there are defendants who can't pay, then there has to be a community service or a program option. And then finally, if there's deliberate, willful, non-respect for authority, then the court has to do what they have to do. The biggest difference here is that you switch the focus, and this is the hardest thing. And this is what Mr. Castile and Ms. Williams and I and the rest of us have to work on day in and day out, helping courts and communities to switch their focus. Instead of letting things drop to the back, switch their focus to the front end. And there's a reason, a big reason, that you want to do that. Let's take a look at the front end. And here's the big reason why the private sector focuses on the front end. So what is the front end? 0 to 60 days of delinquency. That's the front end, historically. That's the first critical 60 days. Now, what do you do in that 60-day period? Well, you can do a lot of different things. You can make calls. You can send notices. You can grant extensions. You can reschedule plans. Now, the private sector does this. They do this religiously. If you've ever been unfortunate enough to go past due with a creditor, the first thing that they want to do is get you back current. They may give you an extension, even rewrite your contract, do everything they can to keep you current, and there's a reason for that. If you go below that 60 days, there are other things you can do. We call that the back end. Added fees, suspensions, warrants, all of the things that you do to increase the pressure on individuals to pay. But here's the big reason the private sector does what they do. In this first 0 to 60 days, you can recover up to 98% of what's outstanding. If you let it slip and go past to the back end, only 30%. So it's in everybody's best interest to focus on that first 60-day period. Put your effort there. Okay. This is just pure physics to me. For every day that a debt remains uncollected, the likelihood it will remain uncollected increases. That's just pure physics. And I always like to give this example. If this was, it's filled with water, but if it was filled with your favorite cold, icy beverage, and I wanted to transfer it over to Carolyn so that she can have it because I'm done with it. Pretty simple. I could just do this, right? But what if I added time and distance? What if I separated them by time and distance? What if I set this glass on the floor and I stood on the table and tried to pour it? That's just physics. I'm not going to get all this in this glass. And that's all this is, pure and simple physics. If you don't jump on it and you don't jump on it quickly, the likelihood you're going to get your money back plummets. Here's a classic example. This is a real example from a city where a collection manager, a new collection manager, came in 2008. And what that manager noticed, and you can see for yourself, is that he collected more money during the month of August in 08 than his predecessor did. But he also noticed that he had more cases, and he had a larger assessment to work with. And he also noticed that his collection rate was a lot less. So what happened? What made the difference? Well, when we did a little research, we discovered that at some point after he took over, he lost an employee. And he decided not to fill that position for a little while, for budgetary reasons. But when he did that, the previous manager made phone calls 2 days after default. Because he had limited resources now, they didn't make phone calls until 20 days after default. You know what that cost him? $70,000 a month. That time. Look at it this way. My payments due on the first, under the old plan, tick, tick, in the second day, I'm being contacted about making that payment. In the new situation, it's 20 days, tick, 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 tick. And what am I running into?
Next payment.
Payment number two, right? So here I am on the 20th, just making that call. Now I should be talking about two payments, not one. And that's what occurred. That simple little shift in time cost him $70,000 a month. Voluntary programs. The Office of Court Administration, back in the early 90s, began to look at a different process for collecting court fees and fines. You've seen the old processes, the blunt approach or the benevolent approach where you give somebody $5 a month forever and ever, amen. Well, this approach was based on taking what they do in the private sector and making a practical application of that in the courtroom. And Dallas County was one of the counties that initiated this, but the Office of Court Administration was looking at this and they adopted that program back in the early 90s. And I think I am going to show you a clip. Now, I'm going to caution you when I show you this clip. It's old. It's not like black and white or, you know, where you have to read the pictures. It's not that old, but it's old. But what I don't want you to do is this. If you're from a smaller city, I don't want you to look at this and say, well, that's good if you're Dallas and you got a bunch of money and you can go out and hire a bunch of people. We've got something for you to look at. This is just the concept that we want you to see, kind of how this works. And what I'd like for you to do is take a look at what occurs, the interaction occurs, from starting with the judge all the way down to the collections department itself. It's as loud as I can get it, so hopefully you can hear it.
The Dallas County Criminal Courts initiated a pilot program designed to enhance compliance for collections of fines and court costs. Three county criminal court judges participated in the program when it was launched with a two-person staff and an annual budget of $75,000. The program proved to be such a success that in 1995 it expanded to include 10 of the 11 Dallas County criminal courts. Defendants and their representatives have advance notice that all fines and court costs will be due at the time of the pleading or judgment. They are also informed that if payment is not made in full, the defendant will be instructed to report to the collections department and given directions to its location. The judge repeats the notice in court.
Hi, you are J.D. Munson? You stand charged by information with the offense of driving while intoxicated. Do you understand the charge against you? The maximum penalty for this type of offense is 180 days in the county jail and a fine of $2,000. Do you understand that?
Yes.
You have the right to have a jury hear this case, or you may give up that right and enter a plea of guilty or no contest. Is that what you want to do today? And what is your plea?
No contest.
All right. Accept your plea of no contest. Find you guilty as charged. I'll set punishment according to the plea bargain agreement, 180 days, probated for 2 years, a fine of $800 together with costs of court. You'll be on supervised probation and will need to complete the alcohol education program and the victim impact panel. All right, Mr. Munson, are you prepared to pay your fine and court costs today?
No.
You don't have the money to pay it all. All right, you understand that you will need to go to the collections department after you leave here and talk to them about setting up a payment schedule. You understand that? All right, when you leave here, if you'll go back behind you out that door to the clerk's office, they will get you the information about your fine and court cost and direct you to the collections department. You understand what I'm saying? Okay. and you understand if you don't pay your fine and court cost on this case through the collections department, that I will issue an arrest warrant for you and bring you back down here. You understand? Okay, thank you very much.
Upon arrival to the collections department, defendants receive instructions from one of the processing clerks.
I need to have you read that, sign it and date it, hand it back to me. It's explaining the process you're going to go through. Fill this application out front and back.
Detailed financial and personal information is needed from the defendant, and the information given is verified. Processing, depending on the amount of court traffic, can take from 45 minutes to 2 hours. During this time, defendants are asked to wait in the hall until it's time for an interview with a revenue officer. Revenue officers review the information on the defendant's application and set the terms for payment. Established terms are 50% of the total due to be paid in 48 hours, 80% in 30 days, and full payment within 60 days.
Basically, what we're going to be doing is we're going to have $300 that's due by January 27th. Okay. And you got two payments of $150. That was due on February the 27th, then March 27th. Okay. Now, as long as you make this payment.
Every aspect of the defendant's responsibility for payment, including terms, method, and consequences for noncompliance, will be addressed in the interview. No detail is too small.
Come up the top of the stairs, right to the right hand side, and you say, misdemeanor night drop. Okay, now they have their own white envelopes in here. You can make your money order out here, put it in that envelope, put it in the night drop. It'll be, again, now, be sure you say it's misdemeanor, because we also know this as a felony.
After the interview is complete, all information is entered into the department's database for tracking compliance. The computer system generates a daily past due list of those defendants failing to pay on their specific due date. The revenue officers closely monitor the list, and they contact and take appropriate action against the defendants listed. This immediate contacting of defendants and the closely monitored follow-up procedure are largely responsible for the success of the program. This year, it is expected to generate an additional $2.6 million in revenues at a cost of just over $200,000.
Okay. What I really wanted you to do is just get the gist of how that flowed and how it was set up. The important pieces in there to me are, starts with the judge. Always, always starts with the judge. Okay, we're going to give you a break. All your fines and fees are due today. If you can't pay, that's cool. We'll take care of that, but you have to go to this department and you have to see them and get set up on a payment plan. And you saw how they went through the process of the application, verifying the application, sitting down with the defendant, going over what was necessary, what's required, responsibilities, consequences. No detail. No detail is too small. They went through the whole piece there. And so that just gives you an outline of how the process works. A fine is punishment for a crime only if it's collected by 2005 on their own. 69 collection programs, 50 cities and counties serving 237 courts, voluntarily created a program. County of El Paso was one of the first ones to create a voluntary program. And they didn't create these programs because it was easy. They created them because they were convinced they would work. So they did what was necessary in order to get going. And all of these, you see these headlines here, these are all actual headlines from those programs after they started their programs. They were tremendously successful. Now I'm going to show you one city that also started a voluntary program. One of your colleagues at the municipal court decided that this may not be a bad thing, so he started his own program, and I'll show you a clip from his.
The collection program that we're looking at installing in Pasadena is essentially a private sector collection program, which will be tailored a little bit to suit the needs of a governmental entity. What we are looking at doing simply is a system whereby people who need payment plans or payment arrangements with the city will be required to essentially fill out credit applications with the city so that we can examine what their financial wherewithal is, what obligations they have, and try to tailor a payment arrangement that is suitable to their needs and also satisfies our needs for compliance with the order.
We found that historically, as far as the court system goes, there's no accounts receivable department. And that's true nationally, not just in the state of Texas. So what this program does is you make a declaration by way of an application, which is pretty much like a credit application. And the whole process, the whole system is set up pretty much the way it would be if you went into any department store or credit institution and said, you know what, I need a loan. And the information is taken, it's verified, and then there are guidelines set up for payment for filing court costs.
Essentially, the system works in this fashion. We have many options to pay and discharge fines in the municipal court. In the first instance, the person can simply write a check and make a payment. The person, secondly, can come to the fine window and make a payment. We have a system in place now where you can mail in a request for defensive driving if you comply with it. You can get a deferred disposition under certain circumstances at the fine window. All of these things are calculated to relieve you of the necessity of coming to court if you can make your payments or secure your dismissals in another fashion. Under certain circumstances, a person can be jailed or incarcerated to serve off that fine and cost. That's obviously a very difficult remedy that we don't like to engage in, and people certainly don't like to receive. This payment program that we are putting in place is intended to reduce the number of people that are subject to arrest warrants for non-payment and calculated to keep people prioritizing their fines and costs in such a way as to secure the payment. It also addresses a fundamental question of fairness. If you as a citizen of Pasadena gets a speeding ticket and you see fit to mail a check in and we have your compliance and you've learned your lesson by way of mailing in your money, why should everybody not be treated in the same way? Now, ultimately, the collection program is about securing compliance with the orders that our court issues, whether they're my orders or the associate judges. We hear cases, we assess fines and costs. To the extent that those fines and costs are unpaid, to that extent also, there is non-compliance with the orders of the court, and there is a concomitant loss of revenue. What we're trying to do is secure compliance with the orders of the court. The revenue aspect of it will take care of itself.
Okay. Totally voluntary. And if you ever are in Pasadena, I would encourage you to stop by and see George Rourke and what he has there in Pasadena, his collections program. It's something to take a look at. How successful were these programs? Well, through FY 2004, 91% increase, $39 million. Through FY 2005, 86% increase, $42 million additional. And no good deed goes unpunished. These programs were so successful that in 2005, Senate Bill 1863 was passed, and the legislature said that 78 cities and counties, 54 counties, 24 cities, had to create collection programs based on the Office of Court Administration model. And these are the four components that those programs had to adhere to. They had to first of all, and this is important, it requires specific in-house management of current cases as outlined by OCA, which means the focus is on the front end. Now, it's not just on the front end, but the main focus is on the front end. There is also a component that requires strict management of delinquent cases, the back end. You have to report annually, and instead of saying, if you do all these things, we're going to give you sugar and honey and all that kind of stuff, they said, we're going to ding you if you don't. So if you don't do it, there's punitive measures that the state will take. The Office of Court Administration, in response to that law, created 4 satellite offices and 6 regional collection specialists, excuse me, 5 regional collection specialists. And an accountant to make sure that the results that were acquired from this creation was actually working. You have 2 of those regional collection specialists here with you today, Mr. Castile and Ms. Williams. Now, these people were extremely passionate, and one thing about those individuals, let me back up for just a second. I didn't spend enough time there, and I'll back up for a minute. I want you to get a good look at them because I'm going to spring something on you in a second. It's Melissa Williams in North Texas, that great part there. She has that section there. She actually started over in Randall County, the district clerk's office there, with the collections program based on the voluntary program. She moved to a voluntary program that was created in Gainesville not Denton County, but I can't think of
Cook County.
Yeah, Cook County. I'm sorry. And then over in the corner there, you have the East Texas, you have Chad Graff. Chad started in East Texas. He started in Marshall, but then he took over a voluntary program all the way up in Lubbock. Imagine his surprise. He called me and said, "I'm in Lubbock, and there are no trees." But he came from East Texas, and it was a whole different culture shock for him. Then he went back to East Texas to work with Smith County, and now he's working for us. Carolyn, you will hear from her shortly, but she started in Harris County. She was the deputy for the collection department there.
Supervisor.
Yeah, supervisor for the collection department there in Harris County. Daphne used to work, she's the central regional collection specialist. She used to work in Dallas County, Dallas County Criminal Courts. Mr. Castile helped create the Hidalgo County program. So all of these individuals came out of the voluntary programs, came out of the voluntary process. And they are so passionate and were so passionate about what they do, they created their own superhero mantras. So now, which one of these you think is Mr. Castile or Carolyn?
Super.
Superman is Mr. Lane.
Oh, yeah, right. You all think about that. But this gives you the essence of the people that you have to work with. You guys all have regional collection specialists. These are very dedicated individuals who can help you with your collections issues. And they came up with their own mantra from a movie, the movie Batman. I'm going to play the clip where they got the mantra from. See if you can pick it up.
Who is he?
He was a farmer, and he tried to take his neighbor's land and became a murderer. Now he is a prisoner.
What'll happen to him?
Justice. Crime cannot be tolerated. Criminals thrive on the indulgence of society's understanding.
Ah, what do you think they picked out of there as their mantra? Criminals thrive on the indulgence of society's understanding. That's what they fly their flag on. So these are very dedicated people. I would suggest strongly that you use them. Pre-mandatory program audit, post-mandatory program audit, compliance audit. This is what the Comptroller of Public Accounts has to do with the mandatory programs, not the voluntary ones. They do a pre-program audit to see what the rate is before the program starts. They do one to see what the rate is after it starts, and then they go in to see if people are actually doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, the only way you get penalized is not if your money goes down or if your collection rate doesn't go up. It's if you don't do the compliance piece. You have to do the program. They are so convinced that if you do the program, you will have an increase, that's connected to the punitive measures. So all of the model programs out there, all they have to do is the program. The Office of Court Administration has a database that's been created for these programs so they can go in and record their results. And ultimately, this is what the results look like through 2009. And we love the numbers, we love the results, but what we're more into is more what a Justice of the Peace Court judge called and left a message for me one day. And I'm going to play it for you. You have to listen really close because I'm not really sure how much volume we have here. But this is kind of how we equate our success and the success of the program.
Hi, Jim. This is Judy Yobbs. I'm a JD over in Williamson County. And I had an unusual problem from my auditors, and I wanted to share it with y'all. And it was because my fines and my fees of office have gone up, and they want to know why. And I thought you would find that interesting because I'm attributing a large percentage of it to my collections officer. Just if you need any information or wanted to suggest how I can explain it to them, my phone number is 238.
See, that tickles me to death.
So if we leave you a message, we have to be real polite?
Yeah, well, no, she...
I end up at a conference?
She was being nice, but, I mean, we just get really excited when ultimately there's success. And when you have the kind of success that the auditor's coming by and saying, you know, you never had this kind of numbers before, this kind of money coming in before, what's going on? Something's going on, you got to tell us. Well, then we know it's working. And that's what it's all about for us. So, what does the enforcement model look like? Very quickly. Staff for staff time dedicated to collection activities. You have to have someone to do this. You have to have someone to do this. Now, they don't have to do it all the time, but they do have to have a focus, and that focus has to be partly on collections activity. And one of the reasons that we have so many warrants, and one of the reasons that we fail many times, is because we just kind of let this go. You know, we just kind of set it aside. So this is extremely important. The expectation that all court costs, fees, and fines are generally due at the time of sentencing and pleading. That is huge. That is huge. You go into a restaurant, there's an expectation as to when you're supposed to pay, right? Should be no different in the court. And that should be generally known. When are you supposed to pay? That should be something that you have already set up. They're all due when you come to court. Expect it. In most cases, defendants unable to pay on the date of sentencing or pleading are required to complete an application for extension of time to pay. Very, very simple. If you're going to allow somebody to leave the court without paying, you need to get information from them. You need to get information from them. Anybody not doing that now? Or how many of you do it now? How many of you actually get applications? Very good. Excellent. Talk more about that in just a second. The application is verified. Now, in Dallas, we verified every single piece on the application. Mandatory programs only require two pieces of verification, and we'll talk about that in just a second, too. Payment terms are usually strict. Now, this is different. And you saw, this is just an example. This is the Dallas example. Half in 48 hours, 80% in 30 days, and all of it within 100 days. Now, the collections manager for Dallas didn't set those terms. The judges did. The judges said, this is what we want. This is how we want it done. And that was a change in paradigm. What they're trying to do is they're trying to get these people out of the system as quickly as possible. Because they know the longer they stay in the system, the more risk there is for them to get into more trouble and to never ever pay their existing court cost fees and fines. So they want to, so yeah, it hurts a little bit. But that's what they're trying to do, get them out of the system. Alternative enforcement options, we've already talked about that. That's part of the program. There are those people who really can't pay. So you need to work with or develop resources for community service. That's important. And it's also important, I like what you said, Judge, because a lot of times I would have, and I'll give you a perfect example. I had a young man come through my department who said, not working, can't pay. But this guy looked really good. I mean, he was wearing, you know, nice clothes. He wasn't in a tuxedo or anything, but he had, you know, a nice polo shirt on, and, you know, he's fairly well-dressed. Okay, you can't pay. Well, you know what? We have something called community service. Now, here's what you'll be doing. In the county option, we could send him to Road and Bridge. Road and Bridge means that you could be doing anything from picking up stuff on the highway to working in the recycling plant. Recycling plant is not air conditioned. you need to bring your own sack lunch. They'll provide water for you. Hold up. I can't do that. Well, why can't you? Well, because I'm in school. Oh, okay, that's okay. When you go to school? Well, I go to school in the mornings. That's okay. We have an afternoon shift. We can set you up to come in the afternoon. Wait a minute. I don't know if I can. Well, you have an option here. He came out and paid the whole thing off. He had the money in his pocket. His father sent him down. He went to SMU. His father sent him down to pay it all. But while he was in court, he heard confusion. He heard a lot of different things. And ultimately, he figured out, you know, if I can get this little payment plan thing going or talk somebody into just giving them 10 of this $850 today, the better off I am. So this works, but you have to have those options. And you know what? The community service, we had a nonprofit that we sent people to, but these were only people who were very limited physically because it was stuff like working at the library, and we'd actually have people beg to go to that. You know, please send us over there. Because they really wouldn't do anything but sit around a table all day long and eat pizza. So what we wanted them to do is actually go and have some incentive for doing something. Plus, the stuff they did for the county actually helped the county. You would be surprised how much money the workers from fines and fees saved the county in terms of the recycling center, lawn care, anything that was ever had to be moved or anything that the county would usually pay for. That's what community service is, community service. Defendants are closely monitored and action is taken promptly for noncompliance. Extremely important. The back end is important too. One of the things you can do if you're not doing anything at all is to contract with a service, an agency, or a firm to work the back end for you. Application of statutory permitted remedies, non-renewal of driver's license, and vehicle registration. And last but not least, the issuance of service of warrants as appropriate. Now I'm going to go through this next, these components real quickly, and then we'll get into tools. But if you have any questions as we go through these, please feel free to ask me. Model components. Now this is what we call a full set of model components for a program that you would look to put together. And I'll give you some things here shortly that if you are just looking to start small, how you can do that. First thing, written procedures. Extremely important. In those written procedures, you don't have to create a policy book. You don't have to, you know, sit down and have somebody come up with a manual that thick. This is what you do and how you do it. Most of the policies through the programs and the voluntary programs were created through memos and created through interaction with processes that needed to be done as they were actually developed. So you could have a book of memos that says this is what this responsibility for, this is what you do in this instance. All of the things that we put together from guidelines to how you approach payments, how do you start with somebody and have them sit down and say half is due today. And we had signs posted everywhere that said half is due today because we wanted to be inside their heads before they even sat down there. And you would be surprised. You don't think they read? Put up a big sign that says free lunch. I promise you they read. So written procedures, extremely important. And what else does written procedures do for you? The only consistent thing about life is it's consistently changing, right? So people are moving in and out, in and out. If they moving in and out, your policies and procedures do not. They stay there. They're the one thing that's always there. So somebody can easily come back in, and the first thing you have them do is sit down and say, okay, here's the deal. Sit down there and read it, and then we'll talk more about it. So extremely important. Dedicated staff, we talked about that also. And it's, you know, you want to get somebody, unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to look at this, that's predisposed to doing what you want them to do. Yeah, if I am really, really good and quick and fast at filing, but I hate dealing with people, then I'm probably not going to be the person you want to have certain areas of collections involved in. Because ultimately, collections is about confrontation. And if you have people who shy away from that, you do them a disservice if you put them in that position where they have to confront people. Dedicated staff. Immediate payment expectation. And again, all we're doing is rolling back through what I've already gone through before. But this is just all of the different ways you can approach immediate payment expectation and why it's necessary. You set the whole tone by expecting this. We had one individual program who actually sent out with letters before you came to court saying that, you know, if by some chance you entered a no contest or you were found guilty, so much money would be due, so bring so much money with you when you come to court. And guess what happened? People would come up and they'd have so much money with them when they came to court because they knew what they were going to do. But that was the expectation. If you have the expectation, usually people will follow through. The application and contact information, again, extremely important. How many of you form some of your stuff out? You have a contractor or a law firm or agency or something that you contract out to. You know what the first thing is they do with your stuff? What do you think? When they first get it, what do you think the first thing they do? Skip trace it. Get good addresses, good phone numbers. That is a huge statement as to why this is where you should always start. Getting good information before that person leaves is essential to making sure you have what you need. It serves two purposes. One, it tells me that somebody's going to ask me for this information. That must mean they must be serious about collecting it. And two, this may be the only thing you have once they leave that will allow you to reconnect to that person if you need to. Verification. Now, why would you actually verify information on the application? In the mandate, the mandated programs, they're required to do home contact or contact information and employment information. Now, we did more, but our program wasn't mandatory, it was voluntary when we started. So why on earth would you verify the application? Why would you want to do that?
Because
they like it. Thank you. Give the lady your hand. She's absolutely right. They don't always tell you the truth. And you would be surprised when you say, complete this, and they hand it back to you. When you look at it and you say, you didn't put this or you didn't put that or you didn't do this or you didn't do that, the reaction you get when they find out they have to start all over if they don't give you what you need. And what are you after in this application? Think about that. It's an application of contact information. You know what you want, but they don't. See, if I wanted to go down to El Paso Mercedes-Benz and get the 450 SL gold package loaded, fill out my application, what do I want it to look like? I want it to be good. On the other hand, if I'm trying to get some food stamps or something, I probably want to show that I need some help. So how does the defendant approach filling out this application? Because they don't really know what you're looking for here. And all you're interested in is one thing. One thing. What is that? The truth. So that's what you tell them. No games. You know, you're not applying for credit here. What we're trying to do is establish something for you. So all we want you to do is tell us the truth. But you still verify it. Defendant interview. Anybody heard of a place called Renter Center? There are places who make a lot of money and do very good business, and they negotiate with people to sell them or rent them, rent to own, expensive appliances, electronic equipment, furniture. And a lot of this is to people who have already demonstrated and proven that they're not creditworthy. So what do that's different? Well, one of the keys to what they do is they have an interview process that leaves no misunderstanding. You can have this, you can own this, as long as you what? Pay for this. And the one in the 60 seconds that you stop paying for it, you will not have it anymore. Period. They make that crystal clear, and it works. You have the opportunity to do that with the people that are in the court, is to make them understand crystal what responsibilities are and what the consequences are for failure. And if you do that right, I promise you, you will never have to call them, ever. Now, I didn't say they wouldn't go past due. What I said is you would never have to call them, because they will call you. And that's much better than you having to go through that file or look them up because they're past due. This is a tremendous opportunity, and most of us don't take the time. You saw the gentleman on the tape who was going through every single detail of what needs to happen. Why would he do that? What's the number one reason people don't pay? Confusion. So you want to make sure there's no room for confusion. In fact, that gentleman, if you would have looked closely, had a checklist. Checklist almost just like a mortgage checklist. And every single item that he covered, once he covered it, he checked it off with his checklist. All of those revenue offices operated that way. And I can promise you, after about 3 weeks, they don't need this checklist anymore. It's all up here. But they still do it. And why do they do it? First of all, it gives all of us a high level of confidence that what we want said is actually said, so that the defendant can't come back and say, they didn't tell me this or they didn't tell me that. Everybody does the same thing the exact same way each and every time. Payment terms, extremely important. And there are several different things in play here because you deal with several different, you know, no defendant or no case is exactly the same, even though they may be charged with the same thing. But ultimately, the judge says how this goes. The process of the program is not going to conflict with the judge's discretion, the judge's authority to say what it should be and what it shouldn't be. But we have judges who don't want to be involved in that. All they want to be involved in is saying, here are the facts, this is the fine, this is the fee. They'll figure out what your ability is and what you need to pay, or they'll establish guidelines for the collections people or the compliance people so that they can set up a process. The main thing with payment terms is you don't want to set people up to fail. And that's what that whole exercise with Mr. Castile was about this morning. The guy who beat his wife. Domestic violence has absolutely nothing to do with financial ability. But without the opportunity to know what's really going on, pretty much everybody in here said this guy was poor. Well, he wasn't poor. He was a third generation car magnate from an area I'm not going to tell you about. It's a true story. Makes about $300,000 a month, easily. But domestic violence has nothing to do with financial ability. We have to have the facts. Once we have those facts, let me make this one point. I have been in courts where judges say everybody gets $50 a month. Everybody. When I ask the judge why you do that, the response is, this kind of seems fair. $50 a month. What do you think about that? Would it be fair for Bill Gates or Oprah Winfrey? And there are some people, I'm telling you, $50 a month is really tough to come by. But just to take a broad stroke and say this is what you do, this is what everybody does, makes no sense. If you kick it up to a higher level, to a felony level, where somebody's going to be on probation for 10 years, and you say, okay, you can pay this out over the next 10 years, and it's only $75 or $200 or $300, doesn't make any sense. So this is an attempt to help it make sense. This is an opportunity when you're looking at payment terms to say, we want this person to pay this. But at the same time, and this is going to sound funny, we want these people to pay this. Yes, sir?
Also, lots of times we just think in terms of 30, 60, 90 days.
It's true.
However, there's a huge segment, at least in our economy in the San Antonio area, people that get paid weekly.
Yes.
So saying 30 days is just like saying, you're never going to have this mother at one time.
That's a good point.
They get paid in terms of 30, 60, 90 days.
It's true.
However, there's a huge segment, at least in our economy in the San Antonio area, people that get paid weekly.
Yes.
So saying 30 days is just like saying, you're never going to have this mother at one time.
That's a good point.
They get paid weekly, then you have to deal with them weekly. If they get paid on Friday, then maybe it's hard for them because they're working in jobs where they can't even get into court during the hours we're open.
Mm-hmm.
But the most success I found is saying, well, then let's do something on a weekly basis so that you
that's
know
an excellent
that
point.
Discretionary part, whatever it is, whether it's $5 or $10 a week,
right.
Well, that's $40 or $50 a month. But if you wait until the end of the month, they ain't going to have it.
It's not going to have it. And I did, and that's a good point. I argued with a lady for a good 20, 25 minutes. She insisted that she could not pay $100 a month. And she was adamant. We went back and forth. We settled on 25 a week. She could do that. That she could do. But that illustrates what the judge is talking about, the mentality. She didn't think in terms of months, in weeks. If you don't get it by Friday, you know, beyond that, that's a whole other condition. So that's, you're right. You have to be able, you have to have somebody sitting there to do that in order to comprehend that. So if you cookie cut things, it's okay to set perimeters and to set guidelines, but you got to have somebody there to sit down and go over these terms and do that interview piece.
I had a question for you.
Sure, go ahead.
I think you're skipping.
Okay, I'm sorry.
The federal guidelines on indigency,
mm-hmm.
Is that just a factor we take in, but it's ultimately our call? That's what I'm hearing, right?
Actually, there is, we actually have a state statute that deals with indigents. And I will get that for you. If you can email me, I will get that for you. And it really lays out the good structure for an application. Because it says this is what you need to consider when you're looking at indigency. But ultimately, it gives the judge broad discretion to say this person is or is not.
So we don't have to follow the federal?
The federal, as far as I know, when you are dealing with court costs, fees, and fines, that is not in play. The state statute is what's in play. So, okay. Account payable compliance monitor. All that means is that somebody watches the cookie jar. This is the clock. If you spend all this time telling the defendant that your payment's going to be on the 15th, first of all, the judge cuts you a break. You don't have to pay it all today. The judge says, guess what? The judge is going to let you pay this out over 90 days. Great. You're really lucky to get that. Okay? Now, here's how this works. And you go through this whole process and say, you know what? The sky's going to fall in if you don't come in on the first and take care of this. And the first comes, and the sky doesn't fall in. Guess what you are? You have lost all credibility. And you know how hard that is to get back? If you don't have somebody watching this and saying this guy's due on the first and we need to get something, if we don't have anything in, we need to at least let him know we're looking and he should have come in, all your credibility is shot if you don't do this. So this is extremely important. You have to have somebody who's going to monitor when people pay and respond when they don't. Phone contact, and I'm gonna do phone contact and mail contact together because they're important. So phone contact, mail contact. Why is that important? Why is it important to follow up?
Well, they know you're serious.
Right, and we don't usually pay by contract. We usually pay by contact, most of us, not all of us. Because we all have our creditors, right? The creditors that we pay on the A-list, our A-list creditors, we are not late with them. We are not late with them because if we are late with them, we hear from them, and we hear from them very, very quickly. We have those on our B-list that we can let slide a little while because we have a grace period, and we know what the grace period is, and they know what the grace period is, so we can pay them a little slow. And then on the C-list, The C-list people, we can pay whenever we get ready, because we never ever hear from them. So where are you on this list? Where are court costs, fees, and fines? And generally, your creditor teaches you what's required and how you have to be paid. And this is the way you contact them, either phone or mail or both. The best way to do it is both. Many studies have shown that you get far superior results if you do both the phone and the mail contact. Now, why is that? I have no idea. They figured out a long time ago, they used to, when you buckle your seatbelt or didn't buckle your seatbelt, there was a little flashing buckle man that would come out. And they figured out if they put a sound with it, that you would actually pay attention and buckle it. So now most of the time when that you don't buckle, you hear that noise too, and you see the flash. Same thing here, same kind of principle here. So what we generally did is we made the phone call. Three things can happen. You get somebody, you get a machine, or it's a junk phone. You don't connect at all. But the idea is if you do connect or you don't connect, you send the notice out. The notice is your backup, and it generally works. Pre-warrant notice? Anybody send pre-warrant notices out? Good. And the idea behind that is to ratchet up the idea of you're going to have problems, you're going to have complications, consequences if you don't come in, and you're real close to that. You're real close to that. Pre-warrant notice is extremely important. I actually had, I think I was talking to you, Judge, and you were mentioning most people don't even know they have warrants. Well, if you do your program right, they will, because they'll get a pre-warrant notice, and ultimately they'll get a notice after the warrant is sent. Warrants. There's a whole process to dealing with warrants on the back end. There's a whole good back end process. If you have marshals and warrant officers, they don't have to go out in the field to work these. They can work the phones. And they can work the phones very effectively. You can actually hear a badge over the phone if it's done correctly. And it makes a lot of sense to do that, because when you put four wheels on the road, you're burning gas and all of that other stuff when it can be done internally. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that and use your law enforcement to get some of this stuff done. You know, there are usually enforcement person who is out of commission. You broke his leg at the softball or something, and that person can't go out in the field. You would be surprised what would happen if you set some past due cases in front of them, had them made a few calls. And it's a good way to start your process off. I just went through use of law enforcement. Post-warrant notices and calls. I think that's an extremely important piece, because a lot of people don't know that their warrants have been issued. And this gives you the opportunity of letting them know and possibly getting them in. Alternative compliance options. We've talked about that. That's community service. Use of statutory permitted remedies. I think you're going to get more into that in the scoff law, so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to skip past that and get into this. Okay, how do I get one of these? And I'm just going to do a couple little slides here and turn it over to you. How much time we got? 30 minutes? Okay. Real quickly. The four keys. First of all, if you're going to look to make a change and a difference in the way you collect your court fees and fines, you have to develop an action plan. In order to do that, you have to start here with discovery. Find out where you really are. How much is not being collected? What is your total unpaid fines and fees? You have to take a look at that in order to get some idea of what you're going to be dealing with. Then you develop a strategy as to where you think you should be. Then you implement it. Now, here's a key piece. You guys have support. You have regional collection specialists that can help you through each one of these pieces. They'd be more than happy to help you with it. And don't be afraid to change things. What works in the county of Dallas? What works in Hidalgo County? What works in the city of Pasadena? What works for the city of Austin? May not quite work the same way once you apply it. So there, while the model conforms to pretty much everything you should be doing, other different little nuances may be different. So don't be afraid to change it and customize it to fit what you need. Evaluating your current process. This is pretty much the way everything starts. And you need to know that two good things or two positive things can happen from a citation or arrest. And one is that person actually gets to court. The other one is they just pay it and you never have to see it. But beyond that, there's a whole different process that you need to be aware of. And the first thing you need to do is figure out what you have. You can create a blueprint if you start from here, and that's all this is, and keep asking yourself these three questions. So this guy got a citation in my city. What happens if he doesn't come to court and he doesn't pay it? What happens? When does it happen? And who's responsible for making it happen? If you ask yourself these three questions and continue that process, if once you get it here, for instance, it may sound like this: well, in 10 days we send a letter. Or in 10 days, Mary Jo sends a letter. That answers all three of those questions. A letter sent, Mary Jo did it, she does it in 10 days. But you have to make sure when you go through this exercise that you know what you're talking about. Because I've been in courts where the judge said, Mary Jo sends a letter out in 10 days. And when I talked to Mary Jo, Mary just says, no, Annette sends a letter in 20 days. And then I talked to Annette, and Annette says, no, we used to send out letters. So you want to be sure when you go through this process that you really know who does what. And then if you go through this exercise and there's still no response, you do the same thing over again. We sent out a letter, Mary Jo sent out a letter in 10 days, no answer, no response. Okay, now what do we do? When do we do it, and who does it? And you want to do the same thing under appearance. The judge was benevolent enough to give this person some time to pay. What happens if they don't? When does it happen, and who's responsible for making that happen? If you go through that exercise, I promise you, you will have a blueprint of what your operation looks like, and you'll know where to start to tweak it. It may look something like this, may not. Okay? How much is uncollected? How do collections compare with assessments? And do we have an opportunity or a problem? Establishing the financial need, follow the money. You want to tap into wherever you need to go to find out how much money is outstanding. Finance office, budget office, wherever you need to go and actually get there. And then finally, if you want to start something, my favorite question is, how do you eat an elephant? Help me with that. One bite at a time. One bite at a time. So you don't want to talk to these people about stuff they don't really want to talk about. So your council people are usually interested in dollars and public perception, right? So if you talk to them about, you know, caseloads and stuff like that, they're not really listening to you. Judges are usually interested in compliance and statistics, right? Not really all the time, but sometimes they're also interested in revenue. But they're not all about the revenue. They don't want to be associated with just being, you know, judgment for dollars. But they are interested in compliance and their statistics. Finance directors, budget directors, usually interested in the bottom line and whatever the commissioners and council people are interested in. Finally, clerks, law enforcement, support staff. Just, will it work? How much work is it? That's what they're interested in. So don't talk to these people about things that they're not interested in. I'm going to spend just a second on this, and then I'm going to get to one thing, and then I'm going to turn it over to you and let you do tools. The collections conundrum. Anybody know who these folks are?
Dudley Do-Right.
Dudley Do-Right. All right. And the person in the black is? Snidely Whiplash. The villain. I'm going to X out these two people right here real quick and ask you, which one would you more closely associate with being the collector? Black Cat or Red Hat? I'm going to ask you this question. Which one would you more closely associate with being the public servant? I want to take a stab at it. It's hard. It's hard. Because how can you do both? How can you both be the public service and the person that's supposed to get the money at the same time? Collectors generally do not wear big white hats, right? So it's something that you have to work through. That's the reason why you have to get a good person to do this. You have to have good people to do this. Somebody that's predisposed to doing it. Somebody that looks and feels, and all I have to do is point over here and you'll see these people salivating when we're talking about collections. And I'm pointing to my regional collection specialist over here. People who enjoy doing it. There are people in your cities and counties that work with you who actually like doing it. They like working with people because it's not just about hammering people for payments. It's about helping people to accomplish some things that they may not ever do. When I was in the credit and collections business years ago on the private sector side, the best day I ever had is I brought in money from a company that was past due in excess of six figures. It was the greatest payday I ever had. I thought that was it. Brought tears to my eyes. But I had an experience in Dallas County where one of my clerks came to me and told me that there was a lady that had to be 100 years old out front, wanted to see me, wanted to talk to me. And so I was a little, okay. So I go out there, and sure enough, she's really, you know, kind of bent over, and she had not a walker, but a cane, and she said, I need to talk to you. Do you have a place where we can talk? And I said, yeah. So I brought her in the office, and she sat down. She went in her purse, and she handed me a check, just like that. And she said, that's the last payment on my grandson's court fees and fines. I wanted to bring it to you myself to let you know you did not make it hard on him. But what you did make him was responsible. Do you know that boy's in college now? That's what it's about. Responsibility. That's the kind of person you want. Those are the three kinds of people that you're dealing with. 35 to 50% of people you never have to see. They will pay you. 8 to 10%, don't care what you do, they're not going to pay you. But right here in the middle are the mites. They might pay you, they might not. You are the X factor. How you deal with them, the process that you take them to will dictate whether or not they will fall down here to the knots or go up to the wheels. Now, I'm going to go through this and then turn it over to you. Goal identification and prioritization. How do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? Let me show you how this works. You have to identify your goals, prioritize your goals, identify factors that facilitate, and identify factors that impede. So, you also want to be specific, measurable, action-oriented, reachable, and time-bound. If you're going to take action, these are all the things that you want to incorporate. So, if I asked you today, what present conditions would you want to change in your court? What present conditions would you like to change? What goals would you like to achieve? If I asked you to list three of those, and I'm not because I'm just going to give you an example, what would they be? Now, here's the example. I'm going to do it for you. And this is just hypothetical. And this is just to show you where you don't have to have a big department. You don't have to have your council people look at creating a whole wing for collections. You can start very small and grow. So, here's all I want to do. All I want to do is I have high failures to appear. I want to reduce those by 10%. That's it. That's all I want to do. So, how will I do it? Well, I'm going to send some courtesy letters, and I'm going to make some phone calls. Okay? Now I have factors involved in this. I have 10,000 FTAs annually, and if I break all this down, basically that's about 38 a day. The average assessment for those is $225 per case. I'm going to have cost involved with this. I'm going to have some postage. I have some phone. I have labor. I'm estimating that in order to reduce my fines and my FTAs by 10%, it's going to cost me $20,100. How do I get that to fly in front of the council? Well, let's take a look at what I can anticipate getting for that $20,100. If I'm successful and all I do is get that 10%, it'll be a net $204,000. Now, if we jump down here and say, well, you know, $175 is our average. If I do it at this rate, not 225, that's still $154,000 if all I do is get a 10% clearance response. Just 10%. Okay. I only have 5,000 cases at 175. Still, that's $77,000. That may be enough to get you jump started. Do you think the council might buy something like that? Think so? Okay. I'm almost burned up all the time. Keys to success: judicial understanding and commitment, simplicity, internal communication and cooperation, investment in quality staffing and training, investment in efficient use of technology. Outsourcing: do you want to do that, or do you want to bypass that and go to tools?
It's a
tools. Okay, you want to go ahead and do it? Okay, we're going to tag team out of here.
Okay, outsourcing option. We like to say in the last screen that when you use the two of them, it works together. The first one, in-house, again, is where we focus on the first 60 days from assessment. The outsourcing part is a statute where you can farm it out to a collection agency at 61 days or older. But normally it says the two of them work together. When you get ready to outsource, if you're not, these are some considerations. You need to understand state laws. You want to really be brushed up on ethics. It says potential for conflicts. You want to know what's the perception of the court and who's going to delegate. Is there a government predisposition to change? You've got to have technological resources. And you need to know the vendor responsibility and coercive credibility. These are some hurdles. Generally, this is what the vendor cannot do. Generally, they can't pull warrants. They cannot require the defendant to appear in court. They can't set a court date. We kind of know all of this. They can't discount or reduce the judgments. They can't make a payment plan, and they cannot authorize an alternative disposition of a case. Another hurdle, if you are still going to outsource, these are the things that you still have to do. Keep in mind, you still have to maintain control and monitor the file. You're still going to have to track the progress of the collections. You're going to have to maintain accurate and detailed records. And you want to periodically audit the vendor to ensure that they're in compliance with whatever, however you structure your contract. When you select a vendor, you always begin with the RFI. Everybody hopefully knows what that is, request for information. You want to use the information from the RFI to create the RFP, which is a request for proposal. And you want to use both of them to narrow the list of candidates. When you're looking at a vendor, important, how well are they perceived in the industry? You want to see their well-documented industry credentials. Are they valid to operate in all states? You want to know if they have specific case expertise and work plan. And you might want to do background checks on their staff and training. Again, with the vetting process, you want to see who their prior or existing clients or references are. You might want to require them to come in and make a presentation to you and your staff, your counsel, whomever is involved. And you want to visit their facility and see what's going on. Just some things to consider. These are some websites that can give you a little more information about the company that you're looking at. Better Business Bureau, which is probably www.bbb.com. The next one is ripoffreport.com, complaints, and then Google, of course, as we all know, can give you a wealth of information, or whoever. You can type in your name or my name, and you'd be surprised what you can find. This talks about the contract. The basis of this screen is to make sure that you get what you want out of this deal. First of all, you want to customize to fit your needs. You want to define the collection procedures. You want to know what their powers are. What can they do and what can they not do? What is your responsibility? What is the responsibility of the contracting agency? What are the terms of the contract? How are they going to pay? Are they going to pay the court, or are they going to pay the vendor that you select? And then timeliness of reporting payments. You also want to look at the method of payment to the vendor, reporting requirements, liability issues, and collateral coercion. Other considerations, are they able to skip trace? If you don't know what skip trace means, that's kind of what Mr. Layman said. A lot of collection agencies and some of our cities and counties have these high-powered internet-based searches that can let you find someone. You can search by Social Security. You can search by driver's license. You can search by name. Some of them are secured. They're for a fee. Some of them are not. But you want to know if they can do the skip tracing. And most of them, well, they should be able to. Most of them should be able to do it. But do they have skip tracing processes and procedures? Do they record and archive all calls, just in case there's some discrepancy? Are they recording the calls? Most collection agencies do. If you ever get to talk to them, they'll tell you in so many certain words, this call may be recorded for quality training or whatever, but they're really trying to get you on tape. Insurance coverage, you want to know if there's the IT capacity and internal infrastructure. A lot of times these private vendors want the information electronically. So you have to, your IT and their IT, they have to be able to talk and zip, zap, zoom, get the information to the vendor. Online access to reports and case data. Can we go in and look in your system and see what's going on? Business continuity, kit continuity, and disaster recovery plans. These are some up-and-coming industry trends. The first one is selling obligations to private sector firms. The second one is using primary and secondary vendors. And this is something that's new on the horizon. You can structure the contract to go to Carolyn Williams Law Firm, but I only get to keep it 30 to 60 days. And then after 30 to 60 days, I'm gonna form it out to John Doe's Law Firm. And what that does now is that puts the pressure on me, the first law firm or the first vendor, to go ahead and try to get the money and try to collect it in full, because I know I only have a certain time frame or a certain time window to collect that money. So that's something that's new and upcoming. You have primary and secondary vendors. Incentives for guaranteed returns, penalties for not meeting targets, and lastly, prepay with guaranteed returns. Okay, now we're down to our collections toolbox, and this is basically what you need to collect. There are five compartments. We have statutory enforcement, location, validation, communication, and compliance. Statutory enforcement is just what it says. The first part is SCOFF law. Anybody in here engaged in SCOFF law? Anybody know what SCOFF law is? This is a statute that allows you to deny the vehicle registration for someone who owes you, well, everybody in here is a city, so they owe you for a fine, court order fine or fee. For the counties, if you're behind on your taxes, it'll apply as well. It's called SCOFF law. This is our website. It's part of the mandate. It says possible application of statutorily permitted collection remedies, such as SCOFF law. This is the transportation code for cities. You'll see in the bolded part, if they owe a municipality, the owner of the vehicle has an outstanding warrant from the municipality for failure to appear or failure to pay, you can flag that person's car. That's the actual code. This is actually some old information. This says 11 cities and 7 counties. I believe now we have 20 cities and 10 counties that are participating. But that is as of May of 2010. These are some of the cities and some of the counties that are participating. Participation level, why don't we have more participation? Common reasons, a lot of people don't know. Lack of publication and dissemination, tax office security concerns, loss of local fund concerns, and confusion about the process. Currently, myself and Mr. Castillo, we're doing more training on SCOF law and some other statutorily permitted remedies to expose our cities and counties to this valuable tool. And we're trying to overcome some of these hurdles. We're also working with the tax assessors who go, oh, I don't want the people, you know, coming in and screaming and hollering and all that. We've kind of worked through most of these. But these are just some reasons why we don't have more participation. But our participation level is increasing. This is the three-stage flowchart. Basically, the first part is technical. The second part in the middle is pre-implementation. And then, of course, the last phase is implementation. In your technical stage, this is where you get all your information. Somewhere you have your warrant database. Hopefully you'll have my name, if I'm your offender. You'll have my vehicle, my plate number, and my VIN. In the technical stage, there are two ways you can do it. You have to contact, DMV. Used to be TxDOT, NASDAQ, Department of Motor Vehicles. But you have to make sure that everything lines up. In other words, if I owe the city of El Paso $300 and I have a 2008 Mercedes that Mr. Lehman referred to earlier, you need to make sure that when you send that information to the Department of Motor Vehicles that you have my name, my VIN, and my plate, okay? You can do this on your own. You can, what we call, scrub the data, match it all up, or you can send everything to TxDOT, DMV, for a small fee. But that's the very first process. You got to match up the cars, the plates, with the person who is the actual offender. And a warrant must be issued for the cities in here. So what you do is get your data, you send it to them, or you give everything to them and let them match it up. Then you have to submit the flag. We'll talk about the cost in a minute. Pre-implementation, there are four boxes on here. The first one is process development. Second one is city council approval. The contract with TxDOT, and then the media campaign. And what we talk about in process development is you got to define who's going to do what. You got to clearly define the process. Okay, the person goes to the tax assessor's office. The tax assessor will say, we cannot register your vehicle. You owe the city of McAllen. The defendant is then directed to the city of McAllen. He will go pay. He will get a clearance letter, and then he goes back to the tax assessor. But this is what we talk about, process development. Everybody's got to know what's going on and what their role is in the process development. You got to get the approval by city council. You got to enter the contract with TxDOT. And then the last one says to do a media campaign. Anybody participating in the warrant roundup, statewide warrant roundup? You know, when we have the media, if you don't know, when we have our media, our warrant roundup press conference, often the threat is what gets the people to pay. It's high exposure. Everybody stands around the podium with their law enforcement uniforms on. And that's generally the time when the people get the most money, when they know that the warrant roundup is coming. Same thing with this. We encourage you to do a big media campaign to let them know what's about to occur. And then lastly, implementation. Just talked about that. But when it actually gets up and going, again, they go to the tax assessor's office. They're denied, told to go see whatever court it is. They go pay it, they get a clearance letter, and then they come back and make their payment. Yes, ma'am. Oh, okay. Again, in the technical, you have to get your record straight. You have to have the key identifiers, which is the tag and the VIN. You have to do your data scrub, and you have to submit your files for flagging. How do you do that? You have to send it to TxDOT. You can do it in whatever media you decide to, by CD, by email, by floppy disk, although we don't use floppies anymore. Every time you submit to them, it's $23 plus 12 cents for every license plate that you flag. Okay? Whether you flag in one plate or 1,000, it's going to cost you $23 plus 12 cents for every flag. It also says the city may pass the cost on to the customer. Again, process development, make sure that you have the procedures in place for denying the process. Here we are in the good county of El Paso. They've been doing this about 4 or 5 years now, I believe, if I can count right. But the person goes to the tax office. The clerk checks the information, the TACSA. They reject the customer and give them the instruction letter. You need to go see the city, JP 123, whomever it is that they owe. The customer goes wherever they owe, JPDRO, county attorney. They pay and they come back with a clearance letter. Once the clearance letter is given to the tax assessor, they go ahead and register the vehicle. City Council, again, you have to get your processes and procedures approved, and it requires a resolution. The state contract, you need to get it approved by City Council. Again, the media campaign, use whatever avenues you have, newspaper, radio, and TV. These are some of the limitations. The first one says the flag is a soft stop. What does that mean, Ms. Williams? That means if where I'm from in Houston, you can go to the local HEB, Kroger, wherever, to renew your registration. Well, if that clerk is not trained and doesn't know what that little flag means, she can still push the button and the registration can be honored, okay? So that's one of the biggest limitations. It's a soft stop. It's not a hard stop, but it's my understanding we're trying to work with legislation to make it a hard stop. The flag does not affect the title process. The motor vehicle could be sold to someone else, and you can't deny. The vehicle has to be tied to the person with the warrant, okay? Lastly, it's not applicable to new purchasers or dealers. The system will only allow one city and one county entry. So basically, whoever gets that flag on there first, you know, if the city of Waco gets the flag on and then the city of El Paso comes behind, El Paso's won't be seen on the registration. Only one city, one county. This applies to home rule cities only. And unfortunately, counties are only allowed to flag vehicles registered in the county. You all are from cities, you have a great advantage. You can flag any vehicle that's registered in any county throughout the state. Counties are limited to vehicles registered only in their county. Any questions so far? What does that look like over the last four fiscal years? Total collections, almost $1.7 million. 9,400 warrants cleared by the city of El Paso and the county. For questions, comments, information, this says TxDOT, but again, they are DMV now. But I believe the information is still the same. Omnibase, everybody knows what that is. Denial of driver's license. Okay. If you don't, there's the information. Probably this will be the last thing we can cover. Inmate trust garnishment. Yeah, I'm a collector 24/7. Anybody heard of inmate trust? Okay, here's the government code. What that says without reading all of that is, if you find someone who owes your city, county, and they're serving time in TEC, yes, Huntsville, Texas Department of Corrections, you can garnish their inmate trust account. The money that mom and dad or mom and girlfriend or whomever sends them quarterly, monthly for their snacks and razors and whatever, you can garnish a portion of that money to pay for the fines and fees that they owe your city. Yes, you can. Unlike scofflaw, this is completely free. There's some processes you have to go through. You have to notify the defendant. You have to get your judge to sign an order. You have to mail it off to TDC. And they only take a portion of the money. Don't think we take all of it. There's a percentage that they take and they leave for them so that they can have their snacks or whatever it is that they do with their money. A lot of people think, okay, well, they don't have any money. Not true. A couple of years ago, there was it 16 million? 16 million statewide inmate trust fund. I looked at one of the reports. One of the accounts had $250,000 in it. Sometimes these people are locked up so long, they get relatives die and the money is left to them. It's sitting there. And then you may have someone who's just sending their child money or whatever. But the money is there. This is the process. Again, we should have more training coming forward on inmate trust and SCOF law where we just really dig down and deal with this. But basically, they have to be in a TDCJ facility. Generally, you have to be hooked in the FusionNet. If you don't know what FusionNet is, that is the whole system that TDC operates. If you have access to FusionNet, you can find out where the defendant is located, what prison, the address, all of that information. You have to notify them that you intend to withdraw. You have to submit that order to TDC, and generally 10% of each deposit is withdrawn. We're working on some best practices. I think they are done. It's on our state website. Okay, so that was inmate trust. We are out of time, and I think the rest of this should be in your presentation. I hope it is. Again, if you have a brochure, you can identify where you are in the state, and you can hopefully identify who your regional collection specialist is. Again, we work for the state, but we actually work for you. I don't have a gun, but I will travel. And we come out, we help you with anything that you need. Any questions, forms, we pretty much have it all. We thank you for your time, and we really thank you being that this is Sunday, this is optional, that you chose to spend the afternoon with us. We kind of like working with people who want to know. We like working with everybody, but this shows us who's really interested, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you. No, thank you. Clearly, we've got a lot of interest in collections and how to enforce the court's judgment. I just want to quickly, Judge, you were saying you knew that 3 days was.